Welcome to Start Writing. I'm your host, Joe Bendosky, and today I am interviewing G.R. Vicini about her book, Mercy Kill. And we're going to dig into some of the techniques she used to really use the first-person narrative effectively, and talk about some of the reasons she chose that for her story as it related to the characters and some of the problems she encountered in initially writing in that third person. And so here is the interview. Okay, so Gabriella, why don't you start off by telling us about kind of the target market of your book and a little bit about your hook and your premise.
Yeah, so I sort of wrote the book. I started it when I was a little bit younger, and I think at first it sort of, I was trying to hook a younger audience, but I think as I sort of developed as a writer, I tried to introduce my book into an older audience. So I think the market for it is sort of young adults to adult fiction. It's good, I guess, for people who used to really enjoy fiction when they were younger and haven't really found anything that they enjoy as an adult, you know, little slightly outside of young adult fiction. Yeah.
And then how exactly would you classify it? There is some supernatural and some science beyond what we're currently capable of. So when I initially contacted you, I had only read the prologue, and I initially mm-hmm. thought I was reading a techno thriller, but then I started to read about the shapeshifters and I was like, oh no, she's in a very different genre. So how would you genre mm-hmm. that?
Probably sci-fi fantasy, dystopian sort of world.
Yeah, I definitely see, you know, some sci-fi dystopian world, definitely. Okay, and then give us kind of the hook and the premise of your book. And then I did read in your bio, you study neuroscience and you try to include that in your writing. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I've been studying neuroscience for around 6 years now and working in the field as well. And I really enjoy that, and I kind of want to translate it into my work a bit more. And so my neuro work has a little bit more science in it, but Mercy Kill started when I was a little bit younger, as I said, and it's sort of set in a dystopian world where they've tried, the animals have gone extinct, and they've tried to bring back animals in the shape of sort of people who can be both. And the reason for this is that they were trying to recreate the species, I suppose, in a safe way, because humans have been terrified of animals for so long, you know, that they wanted something they could relate to. Yeah, that's kind of, I guess, the hook for the book.
The hook for your book. And then are there any specific aspects of neuroscience that you tried to kind of incorporate, or maybe just science in general in the book?
Yeah, so more just science in general. I've got other science fiction that I think delves a little bit further into the brain and neuroscience in general, but this one was sort of just quite basic science, and I guess how the virus that I use in the book affects the brain on a very basic level.
Okay. Now, you've said a couple times when you were younger, so how long did it take mm-hmm. you to write, and like, how old were you when you first started? Because, I mean, if I wrote a book 4 years ago, I usually don't say when I was younger, because I've been an adult the whole time. So talk to me about when you started and some of the changes that happened as you got older working on the book.
Idea for it sort of blossomed when I was maybe 17. I loved a teenager, and years ago, 9 years ago now, thinking about writing this book, and I wrote these characters, and the characters sort of, the names changed and the plot line changed, and like a lot has changed since then. So it's become a little bit more science fiction-y than fantasy where it started. So
how long did it take you to write it? If you started when you were 17?
I started on it when I was about 18. And then 21, I sort of picked it back up again and finished it last year. So beginning of last year, stretch of right, about 5 or 6 years.
But you kind of walked away from it for a couple of years after you'd initially started it.
Yeah, well, I was doing post-grad as well, so it was kind of a in-the-spare-time thing, which there wasn't very much of it.
This is your first book, and it sounds like you're working on a second one at this point. So if you could go back to 18-year-old you who first started writing Mercy Kill, what is something mm-hmm. you wish you knew as an author when you were starting out?
I probably, if I could tell myself something now, I would say, please plan a bit more about where you want the book to go. I think that if I planned it out, I'd be losing the sort of spontaneity in the book. And I wish that I had known, I think, that it doesn't kill that if you plan it to be something to work towards, you know. But I think when you start out writing, you don't want to plan where it goes because you're so caught up in the moment with writing the scenes that you want to write. You don't want to write in between those. So I think I wrote a lot of cuts and then I had to fill them all in.
So are you a panster, or after your experience with the first book, are you more of a plotter now?
Definitely plotter.
So with this book, did you like plan everything out in full detail, like a plot line and then each chapter, or how have you done things differently in the second book?
So in the second book, I've planned it out by scenes and chapters. So it's quite a sort of detailed plan. And my other series that I'm working on has also been planned out quite a lot so far. And I think that that's definitely a better way to go for someone like me. It gives me something to work towards and to like a goal. Whereas a lot of the time, I think in Mercy Kill, I got a little bit lost. And I think you can see that in the sort of the first half of the book. It's not, I think old me didn't really know where it was going.
Yeah, I found that in my own writing. Like when I first tried to write a novel, I just sat down and wrote a chapter and that was it. And then by the end, I just had a mess of things that kind of went different directions. And it wasn't all connected to kind of one central story. And then since then, my second book, I tried to plan out like crazy, and I found that I hated that too. And so I kind of found myself a little bit more in the middle. I need the big plot points, and then I also like kind of the freedom within each chapter to kind of just see where things go there.
Yeah. Definitely. And I kind of do the same thing. I plan the scenes very loosely so that if I want to change them around a little bit, then it's not going to mess up the whole plot line. And even if I wanted to change the entire, I could quite happily do that. Yeah. I just need sort of a skeleton to work off, I guess, plan-wise. So just a direction. I think otherwise you can tell in my writing that I don't know where I'm going.
There are some, like, I don't know if you're familiar with George R. R. Martin, but that's how he writes. Mm-hmm. He does not plot at all. He just sits down and goes and sees what happens.
And I wish I could do that.
Well, I think he rewrites for years, like not even like for months. Like he spends like 5 years rewriting what comes out of that first draft.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
His work is.
I wish I could do that. I think if I went back and rewrote too much, I'd forget what's going on. But I guess part of that is as well that I write so intermittently that I've got just pages of notes now that I didn't used to have. And I think with Mercy Kill, that's the other thing I would do differently. I'd keep more notes on it rather than having to go back and look at the copy constantly and read through it. I mean, I got to the point where I was reading through chapters over and over, trying to remind myself what was going on. And I think that's a little bit too heavy, especially when you're working in another field at the same time. Yeah, when you've only got moments that you can visit the book and write, then you've got to know what's happening. So I do that now. I keep sort of, I write like a paragraph on every chapter about what's going on and what's happened and what threads I want to sort of carry through to the next chapters. And then I can just read those and go on from those rather than having to read through the entire novel every time
kind of a good idea. Because a lot of times, like, I try to get to my book every day, but sometimes life is just super busy, and so it'll be like a week, and I'll be like, okay, I gotta go read at least the two previous chapters.
Yeah.
So maybe I should track better notes, so I'm not like, I gotta go read a bunch before I can even start. So I think
I think it's such a fun idea. And I mean, you can write it's just a paragraph, you know, and you kind of push yourself into it. And sometimes I'm just like, I don't need this. I know what's going on. And then I'm like, no, future me won't know. They won't know what's happening.
Future me won't know what's going on. That's awesome.
Yeah. I want to be nice to future me.
Okay, so craft is the big focus of our podcast. And so I sent you a few questions and said that the existent narrative is kind of where I wanted to focus in your writing. And so let me give a brief summary here to the audience if they're not familiar. In writing, particularly in first person, a lot of early writers will use I a lot, like I see and just, you know, kind of drowning the narrative in this use of I. But if you think about the actual first person experience that is your life, you don't think I see a light switch. It's just a light switch. It's just that existent narrative as opposed to using that filtering and distancing language of I see. It just is. And because you're in that first person narrative, you don't need to state that these are the things the character sees, feels, and knows. If it's in the narrative, it is part of their experience. And so it was something she had done really well within her book. And so I asked her if she would talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I thinking about that, that I saw, that I heard, you know, that I watched, I think it has a place and it doesn't in first-person writing. Obviously, character voice is one of the things that's really important to develop within your writing. And I think the hole I saw and I heard, I think if you're trying to draw attention to what your character is noticing within a scene, if that's important, you know what I mean? If that's important, what the character's noticing, what they're not noticing, then it's important to say, I saw this. Because I think it gives the audience an idea that there are other things going on as well. But I think it's most important to use that is, and not important really anytime else, but it's when you're having two characters that are relating to each other, because it's important to note how your main character is relating to the other character. So, you know, you'd want to say like, I saw or I heard this happen. But I think, yeah, there's time and a place for it. But I think people often quite overuse that when it comes. What's it called? Filter words, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, filter words.
Yeah, filter words, yeah. So I think people can, they do tend to overuse that, and it gets in the way, and I think it creates a barrier between the character and the reader, because the reader is watching what the character's doing rather than being the character.
I think it is important
to put them in sometimes.
Yeah, to leverage them is kind of an emphasis as opposed to using, you know, italics or exclamation point, right? As opposed to using these very, very traditional methods, you can put in that filter word so that it draws more attention, be like, this is something important that the character is noticing, or at least they feel that is important in this moment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because I guess when you're creating their voice, I mean, you kind of have to make their internal voice and thoughts consistent, right? You've got to make it so that they notice the same things in scenes. I mean, if you've got them noticing this in one scene and then that in another, but like the same thing carries through, it's a little bit inconsistent. I think the reader can kind of feel a little bit alienated sometimes by wondering, you know, why this character is noticing this but not that. So I think in that sort of case, it's useful to say, you know, I heard that. And it gives your reader, I think, a sort of an idea of what your character's power is, you know, what they're capable of seeing and hearing and noticing.
Yeah, well, particularly
otherwise, yeah.
In your story, as he shifts form, what he can see and sense and smell shifts based on whatever form he's in.
Yeah, so you want to show that that's consistent. I think that that's when those filter words are useful, as saying, you know, I can see this now. I couldn't see this before.
Right.
Rather than suddenly, you know, otherwise there's an inconsistent shift in what the character is capable of sensing. And I think that that can alienate a reader because they're like, well, he can see this now. Why didn't he see that in the last scene, you know?
Right. So I think those are all really, really great points. So you are self-published. Talk to me about why you made that decision and maybe some of the marketing tools that you've used and what you found that worked and maybe some of the things you found that didn't.
Well, the reason I chose to go self-publishing was mainly a time thing. Because obviously I write as I wouldn't say as a hobby because I'm quite passionate about it and I really enjoy it. And it's definitely where I want to be in my life. But I obviously have a career that's quite time heavy. I mean, neuroscience is very intense, and it requires a lot of time. And obviously academia is quite, cognitively demanding. I mean, you come home, I think a lot of the time, you don't really want to have to sit through and answer 10,000 emails from your editor or your publisher. And that's the reason I decided to self-publish. So I have my own editor, but, I self-published because, yeah, I didn't want to have to email a bunch of people all the time. I also, it's money thing as well. I mean, I think for a lot of people, especially in this economy, it's you can't really afford to apply for all these things constantly. I mean, a lot of publishers have fees, you know, for submitting things and you got to pay for your own advertising and things like that. So for me, it was just the obvious choice was self-publish, get it out there, get my name out there. And then maybe later on, I'll choose to, if I've got the time and the energy. So with the marketing, I haven't really done that much. So my first step was, I guess, setting up my Twitter account, which I used to sort of like promote my book and promote my, ideas and presence. So people have bought my book off from discovering it on Twitter, and you know, you can see the interactions that you're having with people, and that's really useful. website as well. And that's been quite useful as well for, I guess, people keeping up with me as an author. But otherwise, marketing-wise, it's a really hard thing to find time to do those things. Like it is quite time heavy.
So other than just posting that your book is available on Twitter, mm-hmm. have you done any kind of specific kind of campaigns or ads that are different than that to kind of promote it, or just put it up there and see what happens?
It was mostly put up there and see what happens. I think the most difficult thing is rather than like it's really hard to get reviews. It's not hard to get people to read your book, but as you know, it's really hard to get people to review it. Seriously online, it seems like people just don't want to do that. So that seems to be the most difficult thing, I think, to get people to do.
So what have you done to try and get more reviews, or you've just kind of let it happen and not got as many as you wanted in proportion to your sales?
Definitely the latter. I definitely haven't gotten as many as I would have liked. My strategy so far, obviously, I said that I didn't have much time, and my focus at the moment, I'd really like the book to get out there, but I'm kind of just trying naturally at the moment. And then my plan was in a year I would sort of sit down and put a bit more effort in. I've given out free copies for reviews so far, and contacted people who do like review websites and things like that. But most of them, I think, are quite against, most of them are loath to do a self-published sort of indie author book. They're not really, they don't want to take the time. And I understand that. I mean, there's a lot of indie authors out there.
I think the statistic I read is that traditional publishing puts about 500,000 books out each year. And mm-hmm. indies are almost up to 2 million a year. So
wow,
it's just
yeah.
an ocean of indie books being published right now.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I think it's difficult as well because there's so much indie literature out there. You're not really sure if it's good or not. And there's no one really to tell you except reading it yourself. And I think that's a time risk for a lot of these people to take. I mean, if I was doing it, I wouldn't want to spend a bunch of time on a book that actually turned out to be not professional. You know, like you want to read something that you're going to enjoy. So,
yeah, I think because there is so much produced indie, you get a broader spectrum, right? I think the only thing with traditional publishing is a minimum standard, but at the same time, a lot of the great pieces of fiction over the last years have been indie. One of my all-time favorite books is The Martian, and mm-hmm. that was an indie book, and I loved that book. I just thought it was so good.
Yeah, I mean, Wool was published on Amazon first, so and then look how successful that is.
So what did you say?
Wool, the book, and Wool? Shift and Sand, that whole series.
Oh, I actually haven't read it, so I'm actually not familiar with Wool.
I'm just checking out the author, Hugh Howey, and his books have been really successful, so he did really well. I mean, you can find really amazing books on, like you said, you can find some really good books published, self-published, but you can also find some terrible ones. I think I'm not so much worried about, if I read an indie book, I think I pick up more on errors and like page errors rather than anything else. And I think there's a higher risk, obviously, of finding errors in writing in an indie book than there is buying one off the shelf at a bookstore. So
But I mean, at the same time, there really is a big divide where traditional publishing, is charging between $8.99 and $9.99 for their books. Mm-hmm. And for debut author, indie or not, you're an unknown. And so a lot of people won't gamble on that unknown traditional because the price point's so much higher. It's like...
Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I know a lot of authors just for their debut, they prefer that indie launch because it feels safer. Not only that, I just interviewed a guy... And he mm-hmm. went with a small press, and we were talking about his marketing, and here's the crazy thing. He gets a single report once a year. I was like, how do you know if your interviews and your ads and anything you do is effective to sell your book if you find out once a year, And I think that's a lure of the indie market as well, is because so much of promotion and marketing now is on the author's shoulders, right? Like even even traditional publishing tells you you've really got to do your own. The difference is an indie author can look tomorrow at their stats. They can see the impact, see what's working, see what's not, you know, the next day. Whereas these traditional authors get a report once a year. I mean, you have no idea what's working.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, having that day-to-day report is really useful. You know, you know exactly what's working. You put out a tweet and several books are sold. You know that that probably was what spurred that. So it's really useful for that. And I think, like you said, you know, all your marketing's left on the author's shoulder now. And the other thing for the reason I self-published for that is, as well as that the publishing companies, a lot of the money that they make off you is obviously book signings and things. And I live in New Zealand right now for my work. So it's not, I don't think that that's an attractive prospect for a publisher. They'll be like, well, we have to fly you to America.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my plans are to move to North America in a year, but obviously that's on the back burner right now. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, I mean, how many people are even on the island?
Well, 4 million, but... They don't. There's not a big sci-fi market here. I mean, there's I think two or three like author representatives here, agents, and they're all sort of children's books and biographies and things. There's no sci-fi, and when you contact them, I've contacted one or two, and that's about as far as I've gotten because they both said, you know, well, there's no sci-fi market here, so go to North America.
That's funny. So I think you mentioned that you did use an editor with your book.
So my best friend is actually my editor. So because she's an author, so so she edits my work for me. She's such a great editor.
How was your experience there? Was it just copy editing, or did you do like content editing as well, like the light, both, medium, or heavy?
Yeah, I would say quite heavy.
Okay.
So because she's been my friend for many years now. We have a constant sort of report, which I think is actually has been great for editing because we can send each other documents and they're edited, you know, straight away and you can see what they've done and they keep a constant, like she's kept a constant sort of report with my book and where it's going. And I think that feedback is so useful. And especially with your editor, you know, you want to be told when you're doing something wrong or when you're not going in the right direction and when it's not as exciting as you thought it was. So it is a constant sort of feedback cycle, which is so, I think it's so priceless, really.
So, okay. So on those lines with your editor, can you tell me about one point when she made a suggestion for a big change that really improved the story, and another point where you ended up fighting her on a change she recommended and stood your ground?
There was actually a character in my book that I wanted to have die, and she said that that wasn't a great idea. And she was like, you know, you've already had this person die and this person die, and it's a little bit heavy on the death if that happens. And I did listen to her on that part because she was right. And I sort of thought afterwards, I was like, yeah, that's fair. But I had the scene and I was so attached to it. I was like, I really like this scene. I want to keep it. And she was like, no, that can go, you know? And also I think one of the things that we sort of clashed on was, so when I first wrote the book, I mean, did you read the whole thing? Or?
I'm about 75%. Yeah, actually, I think Kindle said 73%.
Okay. Yeah, so it's written obviously with flashbacks between every few chapters. So it's sort of like it starts as if it's a whole book, but it starts kind of halfway through and then it flashes back to the first half constantly. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because I had the book written as if it was a whole book without the flashbacks, and it was just too stilted. And when I originally wrote it like that, I didn't like it, and I didn't like the way it flowed. It just didn't flow well for me. It didn't have enough. There wasn't enough meaning in between the symbolism sort of between events with the flashbacks and the chapters. I think has been improved by having them staggered like that. But when it was a whole book like that, I decided to chop it up like this, and I think it's difficult. It can be a little bit difficult to keep up with that way.
Uh huh.
Yeah, but I think it's better than reading the first half of the book and just not getting into it, you know. I think it's easier to get into this way. You've got more action, more constant action as well. There's ups and downs, mm-hmm. Where I think before they were a little bit, the lulls were a little bit too big. But my editor, she didn't, I don't think she really liked that, the way it went. And I think we had a little bit of a clash on that. And I did end up publishing it like this, the way I liked it, because I just,
So you continued to fight on it and you said, I'm doing it my way. And just, that's how it went.
Pretty much. And I mean, I have had feedback, about it being a little bit difficult to keep up with. And I guess, I don't know. I always read to the end of a chapter from, personally, I don't stop in the middle of a page, unless I really have to. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, I guess it was a little bit easier the way I read a book. It's easy to keep up with that kind of thing because, you know, it's got a title that, you know, it's not a current chapter, you know, it's in the past because it says, last summer, mm-hmm. or last autumn.
Right. Yeah. Last fall, I remember that. And it actually kind of threw me for a loop the first time.
Yeah, and I know that the first, obviously, chapter on any kind of flashback is a little bit vexing, but I kind of hoped that the reader would get into that quickly and sort of understand how it was progressing. And I had some feedback, positive feedback on that, and I've had sort of mildly negative feedback on that as well. So, so I had a comment on it that someone said, you know, they were like, I really enjoyed this, but it was so hard to keep up with. And I was like, yeah, that's fair. Like, that's fair.
So how do you go about finding new readers? You mentioned Twitter. Is there anything else that you do?
I think it's really important to market among people you know as well. So, I think social media is probably a really good way to do it. And I think that in this day and age especially, you know, everyone's on social media. Everyone uses it all the time. So even if someone's just seeing your book and going, oh, that person I know through this person wrote a book, maybe, you know, they'll want something to read and it'll come up on their suggested Kindle list and they'll buy it, you know. So It is really important. And you get those are the people you're more likely to get reviews from, really.
So do you do,
you know, and the, yeah.
advertising?
Like Facebook, no, I don't. Or, so.
You know, nothing. So
just no, social and media. That's for a money reason. Oh. So science right now is not the most lucrative profession.
That's kind of sad to hear.
It will be good, but yeah, of course, being a student means you don't have much extra finances for that sort of thing. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm planning on doing it, then hopefully it will fund its own advertising at some point, right?
And that's the hope at some point that will tip, you know, and I'll be getting that's what I'll be using the profits for. So that's the idea, really. And I will get there at some point. So I'm just kind of waiting, I guess, until I have a little bit more time and a little bit more sort of extra finances for that. But I will be moving on to sort of more social media advertising. So you can advertise through Amazon as well. They offer that.
Yeah, that's kind of becoming a bigger thing with authors is that advertising with Amazon, as I've been reading and listening to other interviews. Why don't you talk to us about the advantages and the disadvantage of that first person narrative, and then some of the things you think people should really stick to it as they approach that POV style.
Okay, yeah, definitely. So I guess to start that off, I generally actually enjoy third person novels more. And as an interesting thing as well, Mercy Kill, actually, the first half of it when I wrote it was in third person. So I actually went back and edited it into first person and rewrote a lot of the scenes and things. Because I felt like as a third person novel, it just didn't have enough emotion in it. It just wasn't fast paced enough. And I felt like there was kind of a discrepancy between, I guess, what the reader was feeling and what the character was feeling. And I think in first person, it does help you get that emotion into the writing and into the scenes. You know, your reader is feeling what the character is feeling. And I think for a book like this, it's important because, I mean, if your reader doesn't feel like they're the character or they can't relate to the character, then why would they care, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to hook your readers in the first few chapters, at least, to care about the character. Because I know if I open a book and by the sort of fifth chapter, I still don't care about the character. I don't really want to read it any further, you know? it's just like I don't really care what happens to the character. And I think it's really important to build sort of a rapport between your character and your audience. So I think it's easier to do in some ways with first person if you can keep things consistent. And it can be a little bit more fast paced, I think, because your character, it's only about what they're noticing and what's affecting them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in third person, you know, you can go off on tangents a little bit, and where you're explaining things that the character's not seeing. And I think that's a dangerous territory to enter into. I think George R. R. Martin does a great job in that respect, because he doesn't go off on tangents explaining, you know, the world. He lets the world explain itself. But a lot of authors don't do that. A lot of authors over-explain the world around rather than letting the character do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that your character is noticing what's going on in the world, because everything obviously relates back to the main character, and that's what the reader wants to read about. They don't want to read about the next-door neighbor's dog, you know? they don't care about that unless it's biting the character.
Uh-huh. So, in your original draft, did you feel like you did that too much, or was it more just a decision that you felt like they weren't connecting with the character enough?
It was actually both. I think that I did over-explain things, and that was one of that was actually something my editor helped me with, is showing me, you know, it's showing me where in my book I was explaining things too much, and saying, you know, why don't you put this into dialogue and make it so that's a conversation between these two people, because that's interesting to read. You don't want to read a paragraph on this works like this, this works like this, and this works like this, you know? You want your world to be explained piece by piece in a way that the reader can put it together themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're not really engaging. So, and I think that's easier not to do that in a first-person narrative. So in a third-person narrative, I think it's quite easy to get carried away and over-explaining the world. And you don't really want to read a paragraph on why something's like this,
right,
in a sort of detached way, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you want it to relate kind of the character, and you want to know the character's thoughts on things as well. I mean, you can't really do that if you're just saying this works like this. So, yeah, I think that was a really good way to get emotion into the book and to connect the reader with the main character.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's hard for people as well. Like, in my book, obviously, the main character is the outcast, so people can relate to that quite easily. But I think Rafe in general is a harder character to relate to. And so it was important for me, I guess, to write in first person so that I could get that emotion in and get that connection between the main character and the person.
Yeah, like Katniss Everdeen. Katniss is tough to like.
Yeah.
And I think if that
she's really tough to like, yeah,
been written in first person, I don't think it would have done very well. So particularly you know, when your main character is tough to like, one of the advantages of that first-person POV is a lot of times you stop seeing the character and you just see yourself in the story.
Yeah, exactly. And that can be a good thing to a point. You know, it can be a good thing until... But it's really easy to alienate your reader when they are imagining themselves as the character, because if the character does something that they wouldn't do, it instantly kind of alienates them, I think. And I think that's why you've got to be really careful with putting, you know, yourself in the shoes. You want to be reading through the character, but you don't want to be the character. Because I think that, like I said, you know, if the character does anything the reader doesn't like, it's instantly like a dislike thing. And it's kind of alienates them. I think I've read books where I feel like that. I've read books where that makes me sort of dislike the story and the world, because I'm like, well, I wouldn't do that, but I'm the character now.
That's so funny.
How is this working? But, and I think Rafe, the main character in Mercy Kill, I think he's a little bit like Katniss in the way he's not overly likable in the beginning of the story. I think it takes a while. There's obviously, it's easy to show the character development as well when you're in first person, because the thoughts sort of, you know, you keep them consistent, but they can consistently change as well. And the person can improve or not improve. And, you know, you see these ups and downs. But I think with writing first person as well, you have to be so careful about your attitudes, you know, your character's attitudes, because they don't change suddenly. And I mean, humans' attitudes generally, I mean, they do change over a lifetime, but people are generally quite attached to their attitudes about things. Mm-hmm. So if your character has one attitude about something in one paragraph, and then a few paragraphs later is thinking the opposite thing, you know, that's just not consistent, and the reader's not going to believe that that was a natural shift in attitude. That's just a sudden sort of, it makes the character kind of flaky.
Right.
Yeah. So you've got to be quite careful. But without, like I said, without over-explaining. Yeah. And your character kind of has to develop. But Rafe isn't overly likable, I think. As you progress, you know, my aim anyway was that he, as a character, he improved and he got braver and more of a leader. But at the beginning, you know, he's kind of lost and he doesn't know where he is. He doesn't want to be a leader. He's not happy with where he is. And I don't think that that's a likable quality in a character. But it is also, but it is one you can relate to. I mean, we've all felt a little bit lost. We've all been put at one point in a position of leadership that we didn't want, but we have to take, you know?
Mm-hmm. When you started the book, did you start with Rafe fully developed and then roll that back in revisions or editing? Or did you always kind of plan his character arc this way?
Yeah, I always kind of planned his character arc this way, to be honest. I wanted him to develop, you know, and to mature, I guess. Because the whole point, I guess, of the book, and also the second book, is that the worldview for him is constantly widening. It's constantly getting bigger. And it's always more about other things than him. But at first, I wanted it to be all about him. And not in like an overly selfish way, but I mean, as in like all of us, we're very sort of insular with what we think. So I wanted him to just be focused on his own world and then have to suddenly open that up, you know, and start focusing on other things. And I wanted that to be difficult for him at first, but then by the end of the book, for him to be a little bit more worldly and a little bit more mature. And so I wanted, that sort of development of opening up the worldview and opening up his, and becoming less selfish. But I mean, that was obviously something that he had to get over personally in the book. And yeah, so his friends are obviously a big part of that. Like in any novel, the friendships that they make and the relationships they build are part of what help them develop and the things that they overcome.
Particularly in young adult literature, that's a very big deal.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to downplay the romantic relationships. And I kind of, in retrospect, I think that that's what makes this book slightly more young adult than I wanted, is the relationship in it. And definitely in the second one, the relationship's downplayed. It's not as important. So
do you have a planned release date for your second book?
I'd like it to be at the end of the year. So that would be my plan. But I'd also like, the first one of my series that I'm working on currently, which is called The Arid Cities. And it's set in it's a sort of sci-fi one. It's set on a number of different planets, and it's about an alien bounty hunter who teams up with some other various characters, and they're trying to find someone who's been kidnapped. And that's basically the very basic gist of it. But I'd like that to be released at the end of the year as well. But it's so difficult for me to put release dates on these things because of my work.
Right.
But I'd really like to bring out the second book to Mercy Kill this year. And that's just because I wanted to keep it close enough to the last one that my readers don't just disappear.
Right. That is going to be a big risk with those longer dates. I mean, I know indie writers who are putting out like a book a month. Like, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Writing pace as a way to keep their readers hooked and satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, yeah, even if I was writing full time, that just sounds daunting. Like a book in a month. That's so intense.
You'd have to just be working on it every day, all day. And I just don't have the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I would love to write that much, but I just can't imagine putting out that much content. And I don't know. I just wouldn't want to get sloppy as well. I think it takes for me a long time to process what I want to have happen, and then write it, and then read it, and then decide if I'm happy with where it's gone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because like the ending for Mercy Kill took me a long time to figure out how it all wrapped up and how it would move on into the next book. And the reason that I decided on it that way was because of the feedback that I got from my sort of pilot readers and people who said, actually, I don't think it should go that way. And,
people didn't like the original ending.
The original ending, I mean, it was a little bit too victorious, you know, and I definitely heard what they were saying, which was that it was too kind of happy ending. And I didn't want it to be a happy ending because there's no room to improve on a happy ending. I wanted something to build off for the next book. And I think that I was quite happy with where it ended, because it started off to quite a fast-paced sort of entrance to the next book. Mm-hmm. So the next book sort of begins with a bang, you know, which I enjoy. I like that. I like the action at the beginning, you know. You hook the reader that way as well. So if people like action, then that's... And I think if I had to pick... from my feedback, if I had to pick my writing strength, it would probably be the paces and action scenes. I don't think that dialogue is my biggest advantage, so I like to keep things quite fast paced.
So, what do you consider your the greatest strength in your writing, and how did you develop that?
Yeah, that would definitely be, like I said, the action scenes. So, and I think that to develop that, I guess it took a lot of observing. This sounds creepy, but observing, I guess, people and how they react to situations. Because I think, about consistency before, it's really important that your scenes play out in a consistent way. You know, it's important that your characters do the same things in a way that the reader, you know, not so they expect it, but not so that they're like, oh, well, that wouldn't happen, you know?
Oh, I was going to say, I remember when I first started writing, one of the comments I would always get be like, how is that possible? Look at the physics of what you're writing here. I was like, oh, I didn't think of that. I was like, the chair was here, and then he grabbed it? How? I was like, I have not thought that in depth about how the action is playing out here. So that was a big problem in my writing originally, was just basic physics.
Yeah, I was definitely the same. And I think that's another trap you fall into with the first person, is that you forget to constantly think about where your character is in space, you know? Mm-hmm. You forget to sort of map out physically where they are. And I mean, sometimes I would get to scenes in Mercy Kill where I was like, hang on, he's here, but he was just there a second ago. And there's no doors or windows here, so how did he get there? And I'm like, okay, I have to put in now, you know, I have to put in him noticing, you know, there's a door here or there's a window here. Or maybe he's actually in a different room and I have to specify that because it's not clear, you know? You have to be really careful, I think. And I think that I spend a lot of time mapping out physically where all the characters are in my head. Yeah. And, you know, the sort of spatial awareness, good. Like where are they and what are they doing? What weapons do they have, you know? Because if you're saying, like, he's standing there weaponless and then a second later he's shooting someone, I mean, that's a little bit, like, how did that happen? Where did he get that? So, yeah, you have to think logically. It has to sort of all flow in a way that the reader, you know, they feel aware of what's going on and nothing surprises them. It's not sudden. You know, there's enough sudden things to keep it interesting, but also has to flow enough, I guess, that they don't feel like stuff's just random. Like you're just throwing random details in there. Yeah.
So, all right. Why don't you tell the listeners where to find you and the specific title of your book and whatnot.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter under the handle GR Vicini. And you can also find my website, which is grvicini@wordpress.com. And yeah, that's me. So you can find me there. My book's called Mercy Kill. Yeah, and it's the first book in the trilogy called the Silverus Trilogy. So.
And for her book, there's actually like several Star Wars novels that will pop up before it. So if you're searching on Amazon, you got to kind of scroll down a little bit.
Yeah, and it's the red cover. So it's bright red, so you'll see it. Right.
This was great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It was really nice to come on here and talk with you guys.
Thanks for listening. As always, our website is www.startwriting.space, and our email is pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. The summary and highlights of the interview will be available on my website, josephbendosky.com. And if you enjoy the show, be sure to leave us a review on whatever platform you listen. Thank you.